Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. This program is devoted to those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are rotten to the core, that they are the problem, and that there are, therefore, no religious, political, military solutions for what ails our planet. Our mission, accordingly, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is perpetrating the crimes, which over the course of the next 15 years will continue to wreak havoc on our planet. As a result, in our second hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, because its covenant provides the only reliable escape. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. A couple of announcements to make this morning. The first, it's my pleasure to welcome Scott back. Scott, for those who have listened to this program since its beginning, know that for better part of a year and a half, Scott and I actually hosted this program together and worked together to bring you both the news and the Torah's message. And Scott has received a promotion and has gone up and into sales, but this morning, he is at the controls. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, wonderful. It's great to hear your voice, and I know that all of those who have listened for a long time are glad to have you back at the controls. The second is that over the weekends, early Friday, and really throughout the weekend, purview to communications between Jerry McLaughlin, who I believe will join us in the second hour today. Jerry has been part of the program previously. He produced a movie called A Long Way Away that will soon air in theaters, modeling the story of the prodigal son and setting it into a more Hebraic scriptural context. He and the owner of Genesis Communication Network and its general manager, appears come to the conclusion that we're going to change the timing of the show so that it will start a couple of hours later each day and that it will run an hour longer. So we'll see how all that plays out. I was going to complete our story on the French involvement in the Central African Republic this morning, but Scott mentioned a story that I'm really not up to speed on at this point, but I'd still like to discuss. Okay. The story is that it was hinted at anyway. It was certainly published by the Huffington Post, which is a fairly significant international news provider, that the Pope was claiming that all religions are true. Doesn't appear that he said it in such bold terms. But he is out over the weekend talking about a number of different things, like, for example, he's no longer going to wear the fancy red slippers that Pope's red because, you know, he's going to be a more down-to-earth Pope. Now, what wearing or not wearing little red slippers have to do with his image, I'll leave up to you, but I can tell you that almost everything that the Pope wears, from his ring to his slippers to his Dagon hat and his fancy robes, all have a long history in Babylonian, Assyrian, Egyptian, Greek, and Roman paganism. And so if he were to give up all of his pagan symbols, he'd be essentially nude without any vestiges of the religion. He would lose his staff. He would lose his cross. He would lose his hat and every other item of clothing that he wears. This Pope has been a particular loose cannon. Let's say that from my perspective in analyzing his statements, I'd say that he's at least a suit shy of a full deck. In his comments on economics, which happens to be his favorite. Now, you know, he came from Argentina, where the church sided with the fascists, And when they were opposed to them, they often took a Marxist position in opposition to them. But for the most part, they were in lockstep with the fascists in Argentina so that they could maintain their positions of power, not unlike what the Roman Catholics did in Nazi Germany. His history relative to having a backbone and courage in standing up to dictatorial regimes is extremely poor. And yet now he wants to present himself as an expert on economics. And he spends more time preaching about economics than he does anything else, as if he is somehow endowed with a godly insight in this regard. And what he, of course, touts is Marxism. It's the system that has been the most effective in empowering the church so that its stooges, its victims, become its slaves. Now, the Pope has done everything he could do to embrace the notion that Islam and Christianity are essentially the same religion. The problem, of course, with all of that is that Islam and Christianity are essentially opposites in terms of Islam. The only guaranteed means into heaven is to be a jihadist and to go out and to kill Christians, Jews, and non-Muslims. And in Christianity, it's the belief that your God died for you that somehow earns you a seat in heaven. So there is absolutely no killing involved except the killing of your God. They have no basis in commonality. There is a fair amount of crossover between Judaism and Islam, but only because all of the religiosity in the Quran comes from plagiarized and then twisted Talmud stories from the Babylonian Talmud that were recited to Muhammad by rabbis in Yathrib before Muhammad hunted them down, killed them, raped their women, and enslaved their children. But even here, the stories were so twisted by Muhammad that they have no common denominator. Scott, it reminds me, though, of the coexist bumper stickers, where in this particular case, the only one carrying this alleged story is the Huffington Post. So I'm going to assume that he wasn't that blunt in his statement. But it reminds me of the secular humanists and their bumper stickers coexist. It's the, you know, the Shattering Mist logo is a mock, tries to make a mockery of the coexist bumper stickers, whereby Christianity and communism and Islam and other religions are all presented using graphics to say, why don't we just all get along?
Well, just religion alone can't get along with one another.
No,
they contradict each other.
Well, just think for a moment about being in China as a Christian and trying to coexist with Mao Zedong's Marxists. If you were a Christian and you were not willing to give up your Christianity during the rise of Mao Zedong's Marxists, you could not coexist. They would kill you. If you look at the rise of Islam, of just look what happened to Christians in Iraq after the American invasion, and America gave Iraq, which at the time was a secular country, to Iran. The Christians have been annihilated. There are religions so vicious that you cannot coexist in their midst. There was a significant period of time where Roman Catholicism had such power that any derivations of Christianity were considered heretical. And like for the case of the Anabaptists, the church would go out and try to annihilate them. The most intolerant religion of all has been socialist secular humanism. You know, during the last 150 years, they've murdered over 100 million people. And it's just a stunning death toll.
And water and vinegar.
You know, yeah.
You can't mix them. So
Right. And since religions, particularly secular humanism, socialist secular humanism, cause people to be able to justify wiping others out, this notion that you can coexist and that the path to peace and civility and harmony is to coexist with mantras that are specifically crafted for world domination is as mythical and as stupid and as irresponsible as any.
It means you're lying about what the religions are. It means
correct.
That you're lying. You're not being honest about what each religion is. You're not looking at it. You're hiding things because Muslims are never going to get along with Jewish people. You can't do it.
No, because the Quran is more anti-Semitic than is Hitler's Mein Kampf. And so if you are raised in a society where the culture is guided by the Quran, then you will hate Jews. There is no other possibility but to grow up hating Jews and justifying killing them. Such is the nature of religion. And so this notion, when promoted, which is a significant part of political correctness would have you believe that mutually exclusive ideas can all be correct. Like Johnny and Julie can both come up with answers to what's 2 + 2, and one can say 3 and the other can say 5. And while both are wrong, in a politically correct environment, both are accepted. And
because they did their best.
Yeah. It's like the award for playing in the game, but not for winning the game. When we don't exercise good judgment over evidence and reason, and when we simply accept any old opinion, regardless of whether or not it is consistent with the evidence, then we create the kind of environment where truth becomes extraordinarily rare. And that's very much like the environment we have today. Very few people are willing to take the time to examine the evidence and then to form intelligent conclusions based upon the evidence. And the vast majority of people, since they are religious, are willing to accept conclusions and dogma which are wholly incompatible with their own scriptures. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We were in the midst of covering a story on the French and how their invasion of Mali, which we discussed some 6 to 9 months ago. And at the time, I shared with you that this was not going to go as they were anticipating. All of the articles at the time said that they would come into Mali and they would free the cities of Islamic terrorists and then disarm Mali, and they would leave everybody joyous, peaceful, and happy. And that's what they were claiming. And article after article, not going to get mired in. This is not going to be their Afghanistan. And while it's clearly not going to be their Afghanistan because they're not making the size of commitment in terms of invasion that the United States made in Afghanistan or in Iraq, it has gone exactly as we predicted. The French have been killed. Civilians have been killed in increasing numbers. And all the fundamentalist Muslims did is they faded into the woodwork. They have rearmed and regrouped, and now they attack like terrorists, as opposed to previously they were operating as militias. And there is a difference between a militia tactic and a terrorist tactic. In a militia tactic, you know, you're going mano a mano with an opposing military. In a terrorist tactic, you're viewing the opposing military as being too well established for you to go head on head against them and prevail. So what you do is you attack civilian targets and terrorize them so as to unstabilize the effort and get people ultimately to capitulate. That's what they have done in Mali. And of course, Mali is a direct outgrowth of a consequence of what the United States and Europe did in aiding and abetting the jihadists in Libya. so that they could overthrow the secular government of Muammar Gaddafi. Once that happened, all of the weapons that Qatar and the Sudan and the United States and Europe sent into Libya to kill Muammar Gaddafi have now been used to kill either non-Muslims or non-Arab Muslims throughout the northern realm of Africa. Well, this has now spilled over, as we should have expected, into the Central African Republic. And it is unmitigated savagery that is occurring there. This story continues to say when the French have finished their job, and this is now a Christian group that is communicating. Says, being quoted, when the French have finished their job and they have gotten rid of these people, they're speaking, these people are the Islamic jihadists, we can return, the Christian says. Otherwise, we'll stay here, he added, referring to the mainly Muslim Seleka rebels who seized power in March and then went on to carry out a string of abuses, prompting the creation of Christian defense groups. A little different here in the Central African Republic, Central African Republic, than what we witnessed in Nigeria. Nigeria, Boko Haram has formed a belligerent terrorist organization and has killed tens of thousands of Christians, destroying their churches and generally bombed marketplaces and cafes and the like, with no systematic response. Here, the Muslims were so swift, so vicious, so well armed, that rather than acting as bombers and raiders, they came in and took over the Christian communities and killed every Christian who was unable to flee. And so the Christians have mostly in the Central African Republic gone and gathered together at very public places, like around airports, where they are armed typically with machetes and the like, making it more difficult for the Muslims to attack them, particularly since they've already given up their towns, their communities, all of their assets, all of their property to the Muslims. But they have at least attempted to defend themselves. An assault, and this, by the way, is not occurring in Egypt either, where the Copts Church is telling the Christians, do not defend yourself if you're attacked by Muslim gangs, which are burning virtually all the churches, the Copt churches in Egypt, that your best bet is simply to flee for your life, but to do not attempt to defend yourself, your property, or your homes. An assault on the Bangui last week by these Christian militia, aided by gunmen loyal to the ousted president, sparked waves of killings and reprisals that have left over 500 people dead in the Central African Republic and over 100,000 displaced in the capital alone. And actually, over the last year, 500,000 Christians have been displaced from their homes under the threat of Muslims who have taken up arms and have overthrown the government. We'll return to this story with Shattering Myths continues after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're covering a story about what's taking place in Central Africa. Just recently, the French were authorized by the United Nations to intervene in their former colony under the guise of restoring order. Within the first 2 days of their arrival, two French soldiers were killed. They now have 1,600 soldiers in the country. They have made the same claims that they made when they invaded Mali, and that most of the guns have been taken off the streets, and that the troops have been disarming gunmen outside of Bangui. But those who actually have spent time there, like the Medicine Sans Frontiers, the Doctors Without Borders, are saying no, that the Christians who have been the victim of the violence have simply taken shelter in churches, monasteries, and in public areas, having fled their homes while the Muslims remain in their strongholds and are surrounded by an ever-larging cache of weapons. We have Glenn having called in from Philadelphia who has a comment on this story. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
Good morning, Ada. The French surely you bow jest.
Hey, they're involved in two wars right at the moment.
Three words. Bien Phu. Okay? Which, their history speaks for themselves. Their track record speaks for itself.
Apart from a brief time under Napoleon, the French have not had much of a history of being spectacular with defending themselves or trying to liberate anyone.
Yeah, the Western nations aren't happy unless they get everybody has their own little Vietnam going on at some point, you know.
Yeah, you know, I checked American history, and since French and British and Spanish colonialists began to come to the Americas around 1600, Europeans have fought 101 wars. So about 400 years and 101 wars. So your
and
comment about...
They've all been remarkably successful. They've all been successful because they've all lined the banker's pockets.
They've accomplished the goal. Success, of course, you're not suggesting that they have been good or that they accomplished something worthwhile. They accomplished the perpetrator's objective, which was either to rob people's lands, to steal their possessions, or to enrich themselves and the banking and merchant and religious communities to impose control over the people. But, you know, 101 wars in 400 years, a war every 4 years, it's not just the Europeans that don't seem happy unless they have their own Vietnam or Afghanistan. We in America seem to have the same problem.
It's an addiction. I wanted to back up to the Pope for just a second. Sure. Anybody who studies formal logic, okay, some school kids used to learn, you know, informal fallacies, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you learn the basic, you know, laws, like the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, and the law of the excluded middle, okay?
Right.
Which means you can't have a contradiction. So anybody who says that inherently contradictory systems are going to get along is just insane. Yeah,
yes.
You know, self-contradictory and illogical.
Yeah, in fact... Playing off of that, I think that we have two issues here. One is that you must be either very unique or closer to my age, because those in their teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s have very seldom studied logic. Rhetoric is not taught in school. They don't very seldom hold classical debates. And so one of my favorite parts of my education, which was studying logic and the use of logic, by far the most useful part of my education was the study of logic, is lost on the vast majority of people today. But it is the comment that you make in terms of contradiction, and there's two forms of contradiction that we can speak of here. The way that I went about disproving Islam and Prophet of Doom was internal contradiction. The book says one thing in one chapter, and then in the next chapter it says something else. And if you, the surest way, the easiest way to prove that something is wrong, that it has no value whatsoever, is a internal contradiction. And then there's the external contradiction, where someone, like in Islam, they say the Torah is true, it was inspired by Allah, and that the Quran confirms the Torah. But these two documents are externally completely contradictory, which means that does not mean that the Torah is untrue, but it means that the Quran must be untrue for claiming that it confirms a book which it contradicts in every possible way. And if you are just logical, if you apply evidence and reason, you can absolutely, unequivocally disprove the merit of religion. Christianity is a wonderful example. Christianity claims that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms were inspired by their God and therefore accurate. And yet the religion of Christianity, particularly as it was articulated by Paul in their Christian New Testament, is completely contradictory to what is written in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, making it untrue.
Well, one attempted argument there is that it's not some would say, and if you examine Paul, this is tougher to maintain, but some would say that it was man who broke covenant with God, therefore God instituted the new covenant in Christ. I know you don't accept that, but I'm just saying that's what many would say, that it wasn't that God's covenant was ineffectual, but that humans broke it and walked away from it.
And half of that is true. Man broke their side of the covenant with God. But God, there is no place where God suggests, hints at, or says that because man broke the covenant with me, I'm going to come up with a completely different covenant. And to the opposite of that, what Yahusha says is that every jot and tittle, every letter and every stroke of every letter that comprises every word of the Torah is going to continue to be valid, which means there can be no replacement Torah, no replacement covenant under those circumstances. And then lastly, of course, the only place where a quote-unquote new testament or new covenant can even be derived in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is from Yirmiyahu 31. And when it speaks of the reaffirmation of the covenant, it says that the only difference between the existing covenant and the new and the reaffirmed one will be the fact that the wholesale integration of the Torah will be part of the reaffirmation of the Torah. So the Christian argument can't be made. Well, my pleasure to talk to you, Glenn. Always, thank you. So as we look at the situation here, we have a going from the first segment. We have a pope that has began in the first day of his office saying that his goal was to reach out to Muslims because Islam and his form of Christianity share so many common bonds that we ought to have an interfaith dialogue because the faiths from his perspective were essentially the same. And here in reality, in the center of Africa, we have Muslims hunting down and massacring Christians, stealing their homes, raping their women, slaving their children. And we see the difference between the wishful thinking based upon the ignorance of internal and external contradictions and reality. And what happens, what's the consequence is if you're misled as this Pope is attempting to do. Now, returning to the text itself, it says that that Doctors Without Borders have written an open letter to the United Nations crying out for a response. They say that it's really a mess here and no one else besides Doctors Without Borders is attempting to resolve the problem, and that even the United Nations has not engaged, and that the stench of urine and excrement, they say, and just the lack of sanitation that has occurred by the displacement by Muslims of Christians from their homes has made malaria and other diseases so prevalent that people are almost dying as they're walking dead. The zombie kind of movies where they're still animated, but they're on the cusp of death. It is just another place in this world, like the Sudan, where fundamentalist Muslims killed 3 million African animists and Christians. It is like the Sudan, where the fundamentalist Muslims are annihilating Christians, like Iraq, where they did the same. It's like Egypt, where the same is happening now as well, where the Copt Pope made the moronic decision to stand beside the Muslim general and to side with the Muslim general, not knowing that all that would do is further inflame the Muslim jihadists, which it did to burn down their churches, but that the Muslim military wasn't going to come to their rescue. And it hasn't. That's why God says, I don't want you to side. Don't form allegiances with military units and political institutions and religious institutions. Don't do it. In fact, all the way through the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, where God is saying, don't ever form such allegiances, he is saying, if you will instead rely on me, then there will be hope. I will protect you. I'm capable of protecting you, but all of these alliances with human institutions will be for naught. There's a story that came out of Afghanistan. At the same time that the United States was begging Afghanistan to sign an agreement to allow American troops to remain in country. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that it was the most corrupt politician on earth, Hamid Karzai, that was specifically precluding the ongoing nature of this endless war. He was saying, I'm not going to sign this agreement, frankly, because Americans have killed way too many Afghani civilians, and you're not wanted here. And so if I were to sign this, I would just as soon sign my death certificate, because Americans view our invasion of Afghanistan as this good thing that we did to liberate the people from the Taliban, and the Afghanis view us as a murderous occupying force. And so the Afghani government is trying to negotiate with a fellow named Mullah Baradar. He is the lead associate, the lead advocate of Mullah Omar. In fact, has become the backbone of Mullah Omar, who is the leader of the Taliban. So when we return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break, we're going to examine what it is that made Mullah Baradar so popular and what it is that gives Mullah Omar Islamic credibility. All right, welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is an interesting story. I've kind of hinted at it, but here's how it was reported. Hopes for any kind of peace in Afghanistan largely depend on Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. Okay, so here's a journalist, CNN, saying that hopes of peace hinge on this individual, not recognizing that the individual is a fundamentalist Muslim, is never going to engage in peace unless the peace is defined as he provides a treaty that he can completely ignore so that he has unquestioned control over Afghanistan. And that's where it's going to lead. It says after the Loya Hirja, which is the delegation of Afghan high warlords, the most senior of the warlords in Afghanistan, the council went off immediately to Pakistan. And so after they thumbed their nose at the Americans and said, you know, we don't want you here and we're not going to allow you to remain here, they went off to Afghanistan to meet with Baradar. And the reason they did so is that these warlords know that if they side with the United States is eventually going to leave. And once the United States is gone, the Taliban will be back as if they were never ousted, stronger than ever, better equipped than ever. And they will kill anyone who sided with the Americans. It's very much like what happened in Vietnam once America left. And they know that so long as they are resolutely seen as being loyal to the command structure of the Pakistan, which is in, of the Taliban, which is in Pakistan, then they'll be allowed to continue to be warlords under them. So Baradar, once the top deputy to the Taliban supreme leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, was freed from a jail in Pakistan this past September at the request of the Afghan government to help facilitate the peace process. So Baradar was the single most militant member in terms of the hierarchy of the Taliban, this group that America is sending billions of dollars to Pakistan to fight on our behalf, and they simply released him. They said, the leader of the enemy, rather than us jailing him, we're going to release him because that's what the Afghanis want, who we claim to have liberated from the Taliban. So you're seeing just how foolish our situation is. And so after being freed in September at the request of the Afghan government, he was engaged to facilitate the peace process, which means to give Afghanistan back to the Taliban. Mullah Omar has denounced the Loya Hirja and opposes any U.S. Troops remaining, but Baradar, although he is opposed to U.S. troops and has been very active in killing U.S. troops, he is not opposed to the collection of warlords, happy to work with them. In the world of Muammar Omar, and Mullah Bradar, and many of the Taliban leaders, their path is driven by the power of religious visions and dreams. This is where it gets interesting. Each, quote, true night dream, it's always a night dream, by the way, in Islam, darkness, that was the case of Muhammad as well, is nothing less than a prophecy from God. And each leader's authority comes from these prophecies. The seminal event sealing Muammar Omar's authority as unquestioned leader happened in April of 1996. Then in the dusty southern Afghan Pushtun stronghold of Kandahar, Muammar Omar donned from a religious shrine the holy relic of the cloak of the Prophet Muhammad. In other words, they believed that there were superstitious powers in the in a cloak that was allegedly worn by Muhammad. Of course, that was in Pakistan and not in Saudi Arabia. As recorded by someone in Omar's inner circle, the mullah was then devastated by the Taliban's initial defeat, even though he was now Muhammad's right-hand man after having donned his religious artifact. And Omar, we've heard nothing from him, has been essentially paralyzed with inaction. Muammar Omar could not decide what to do. He simply waited patiently for another true night's dream from Allah. As a result, Mullah Bradar helped to direct a meeting in the spring of 2002 at the madrasa, which is religious school in Quetta, which is in Pakistan, with Mullah Omar's favorite seer. This would be a soothsayer. It was only after the Taliban seer recounted a dream in which he saw Muammar Omar's beard turn blinding white, for it was made of the threads of the Holy Prophet's very cloak, that Omar decided to lead the fight against the Americans inside of Afghanistan. And it is based upon this nonsense that the peace process in Afghanistan now depends. We'll return after the commercial break.